I kind of see this as like, in hindsight, if you were just in the most kind of corrupt, colluding way possible, if you wanted to maintain this extreme asymmetry of wealth, like you would not make that aspect of society visible to people who are getting such low wages.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of people who work in like creative fields that they survive on like 30, 40K.
Yeah.
And then they are interfacing and like on a face-to-face level with billionaires in mm-hmm. some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And that like is not often allowed to happen, but it kind of happens a lot in art.
Yes.
And so that's a very funny point where like these things cross over. Okay, so post Sculpture Center,
mm-hmm.
Where do you go next?
I went to Columbia University.
Columbia University. Yeah. Okay, bring us through that. You are a member of the UAW Local 2110,
mm-hmm.
which was based in Columbia.
Yes. So after, you know, I wanted to work in the arts. As we've already said, it's incredibly challenging, you know, trying to get by on $40,000 a year in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted more time to make art. And kind of on a whim, I applied to work at Columbia. I had heard a tip that one of my favorite artists, Irina Knezevich, was going to be teaching, I think, Barnard or Columbia. I just heard a tip that this was going to happen. I was like, oh, cool.
Okay.
I like her.
Okay.
Maybe Columbia is hiring. And then by chance, the visual arts program was hiring.
Yeah, yeah.
And wound up there working actually with some people from Chicago. Carrie Gundersdorf, a really amazing painter, was my manager for a time. And it was Laura Mascara, also an amazing artist and painter. And the job was pretty basic. I was a program assistant in the mm-hmm. department, so I greeted visitors and made schedules and did the kind of grind of keeping a graduate program running, but it was unionized.
Yeah.
And that was my first time being in a union, and it was just it was transformative.
And you became at some point the shop steward for 2110.
Yeah, I was the unit chair.
Unit chair,
yeah.
Okay.
The steward of stewards, and I was mm-hmm. on our bargaining committee, but I remember just going to my first union meeting and being in this room of like 200, 300 people who I had never seen before in my life, but we were all kind of arguing about the contract on the table, what we wanted out of it, what questions we had, what we're willing to do to win something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just profoundly democratic in a way that I'd never experienced before. And I was hooked. I thought it was so cool that people could do that together.
Okay. So this is maybe like the best possible origin story for me specifically. I'm like a targeted individual right now. To go from art to working in a university, you're in your organized union. How do you then decide to run for office?
That was a longer process, I
yeah.
think. So I was in my union for about 6 years total. But I think, so I got into my union. I thought it was really cool. Obviously getting off at 5 o'clock is like transformative mm-hmm. if you have never mm-hmm. had that experience before.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gave me opportunity and time to get more organized in other places. So I joined DSA, New York City, the Democratic Socialists of America, and got really involved there. And just started recognizing like how much power everyday working people can win when we organize together
mm-hmm.
and how possible it is to do that organizing. I think certainly from the DSA perspective, the thing that really hooked me was the idea that we can build our own machines.
Do you mean?
That
political machines.
Political machines, yeah.
That, okay.
You know, I think politics is always this kind of rarefied thing that like consultants know how to do or people who got political science degrees
yeah, yeah.
know how to do.
Consultants. Claim they know how to
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And they continue to claim it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Despite staggering results in the elections. But,
yeah.
Okay.
Neither
yeah.
here
Industry's
nor there.
Thriving,
neither
I understand.
But it was always this thing that like, well, not available to me or to
yeah.
the people
yeah, yeah.
in my neighborhood. And I think being in DSA disproved that like
mm-hmm.
people can come together because they want to win healthcare for everyone and can run campaigns and develop strategies, and anyone can participate in that. And I thought that was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I got really involved in DSA as well. And it was like part and parcel of being involved with my union, seeing that like, you know, someone with a high school degree could get a living wage and could go toe-to-toe with Columbia University and take on really powerful institutions, profoundly moving and just like really incredible. So I was asked to run for office a couple times. The second time I said yes, finally. and I ran for Assembly in 2024 and won. But I remember the feeling I had when I first said, okay, I'm going to do this. Like, fine. I've been worn down. Feeling like powerful in a really specific way. Powerful insofar as like, oh, there's like, I'm not by myself. Yeah. You know, like I'm with like hundreds of other people right now in every moment. And that's what I wanted to bring to Albany as a New York State Assembly member too. New York's not the only city in the world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't think we should, you know.
Well, it's the one that has the most proximity to capital that mm-hmm. art needs those patrons.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you go to Philly, there's just less rich people to buy it.
Art is also a public good, in my opinion. Mm. And like, we shouldn't be so reliant on like the patronage of the wealthy to make it sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So like what the state's for,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah. Can we start with some art world stuff? Is that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we've done... I'm like in proximity to it, but not a member anymore. So I'll try and like speak
to it. Did they cast you out? They revoked your card?
I cast myself out. You,
okay.
I bowed
you
out.
Left. You left. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't blame you. We've done how many? This is like 47, 48 episodes. Uh-huh. And we've had like two or three artists on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And don't plan to do any more anytime soon. Okay, well, tell us a little bit about your background in art school. You went to SAIC.
Mm-hmm,
yes,
I did.
That's where our tripod over there is from.
Nice.
Okay, so, and you studied sculpture, studio art?
I studied painting. I had like a funny degree. It was like a BFA with an emphasis in art history and criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So I did painting and some art history and fiber arts. I did weaving.
Mm-hmm,
A weird, a funny mix.
How much was theory and how much was studio?
It was probably 10% theory and 90% studio.
Oh.
Yeah. I got the theory out of the way as soon as I could and then spent the and okay. was not good at that part either.
Yeah. All right.
So it was mostly in the studio. Yeah.
That's that sounds like a more enjoyable way to do it. What about the kind of theory that you absorbed in art school? Like for my experience, my perspective. I had a level of introduction to this stuff that set me on a certain course.
Mm.
And then in my adult life after graduation, I realized that a lot of the ideas that I was introduced to in the kind of art theory world were not like left or I don't know what they are. They're just kind of weird academy fluff.
Yeah.
Did you bring any of that stuff with you? Was it influential in any way?
I think it didn't penetrate to a level that it was something that I would carry with me.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I was really introduced to in like art school was the dynamic of being a worker. Mm-hmm. So I worked part-time at Trader Joe's and that kind of carried me through my time in art school. And so mostly I remember it being a balancing act between how do I get enough time in my studio and how do I get the hours in at Trader Joe's so I can maintain my health care and get some money in the door. And mostly that's what I remember. And it felt like the theory was not helpful in navigating those kind of like time constraints and material constraints of being a working artist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Trader Joe's, you'll know more about this than I do, but they're like viciously anti-union. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't really, I mean, I experienced that in some ways. Mm-hmm. We weren't trying to organize my shop at all. But when I was at Trader Joe's was when the company kicked all the part-time workers off of our healthcare.
And so I
got a Cobra letter in the mail one day basically saying like.
And you were one of the part-time workers.
I was one of the part-time workers. Yeah. And had been at Trader Joe's for about 4 years at that point, too. So I got this kind of like very cruel exodus from our healthcare. And there are a ton of part-time workers at Trader Joe's, too, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Is
there a ratio? Is it like 50-50, full-time, part-time, or what's the...
Yeah, I'd probably suspect maybe even higher. I think it depends on the store, but at least the one I was at, there were some retirees who worked there who just wanted some extra, like income. There are a lot of artists and musicians who worked at Trader Joe's too.
Oh, interesting. What particular reason why that was?
Flexibility. And honestly, like the wages were not bad. Mm-hmm. I certainly got paid more there than at some other jobs.
Okay.
And it was flexible too. Like I worked in the mornings at the end of my time there. So I was there 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. and then I'd get out and could either go work another job or could go to my studio. I ran a gallery with a friend of mine, and we would go do
that. Okay. Yeah. Tell me more about that.
We inherited a space in a studio building in Chicago that we ran as a little gallery.
Chicago has, for people who don't know this, like a thriving ecosystem of like scrappy DIY project spaces that are like really influential, and it's a way to kind of get your foot in the door for young emerging artists that doesn't exist in New York.
Yeah, totally.
What was your program for this space?
We really just showed our friends.
that's how people do it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's extraordinary how like the kind of bohemian fantasies that we maybe like come to big cities with are something that existed like literally 40, 50 years ago.
Totally.
And it just doesn't exist now. And I had a, you know, similar experience as you, where I think it was around 2018 or 19, but I broke my toe and I broke my toe on a sculpture because I was storing it in my house.
Because you're backing up to look at a painting.
Well, I didn't have enough square footage to be able to like put it somewhere, and it was kind of dark, so I just like bashed the edge of my toe on this thing. And at the time, I was what was called a permalancer, which is that you're on a freelance job, but you don't have benefits, and you're doing that in perpetuity.
Nice.
So you're basically a full-time employee without benefits.
Yeah.
And I couldn't afford to go to the doctor, but I also couldn't afford to take time off work.
Mm-hmm.
And so every day I would walk this street with my broken toe over to work. And I'd be like, man, this is not what I signed up for when I was doing like Patti Smith 1970s. I'm going to bum around and have a studio.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really thought, and during that time, I just absorbed so much, because I would work these long hours on the computer, like so much theory and like 3 volumes of Capital. But it made me, I'm going to cut that out. No one is endorsing the most important secular book ever written in the history of civilization. But that experience was very radicalizing.
Yeah,
and it made me think that, okay, we need to address this in a serious way, and the fantasy is no longer in existence.
Yeah, absolutely. That is also when I broke from my
my
dream of being within, I don't know, not necessarily within the art world, but advancing in a career that could provide a stable life within the arts. It was around 2018. I was finally like, all right, we're going to sell out and go to Columbia and just get that stable paycheck and get that overtime.
And then it wasn't there.
And then I spent my time doing other stuff.
What about friends, where some of the people who are kind of in these creative fields, they have a lot of like antibodies built up? Or I had a very frustrating conversation with an artist whose work I love and absolutely admire. But I was like, I won't say her name. I was like, I'm trying to give you like an affordable house. Like I'm trying to give you healthcare. Like I'm just advancing these ideas. But she's just really had kind of like internalized that, you know, this is how it is and we shouldn't try to change the world. What have you found is like effective to kind of like pierce through that ideology that like we should just accept that this is the unchangeable tide of the world?
I think this is like the big question. And I think I've been on campaigns before that lost, I think in part because it can feel really hard to push through people's demobilization. And people are really resigned to, you know, getting through the day in whatever way they can. And I have a lot of sympathy for that, because I think I have been in that moment many times in my life. I think being able to remind ourselves that this world was made by people, that it can be remade by people, and that it has to be, and that changing it is going to require truly all of us. And I think we talked about, you know, majorities of people getting on board. It's going to require as many people as possible to come to this work, to decide that like the shitty things about our lives can be changed, and that we can get higher wages and we deserve higher wages, that the deck has been stacked against workers for decades now, and that we deserve so much more. And so I think especially it's helpful that we won a campaign last year. It's helpful to be able to say
it does a lot.
Winning really helps. It helps that we can point to this moment where, you know, 100,000 people said, okay, like I'll knock on a door, I'll like pick up a phone. And that worked. It's helpful to be able to point to good examples like that. And so, you know, I think a lot of my more normie friends who had sat out politics for a long time, because it is lame.
they just became nihilists.
Yeah. I think have turned around a little bit, in part because I have bothered them about it for a long time, and because and because now they can see that they can work.
Positive influence in their life.
Yeah.
There seemed to be a great irony to me of like learning about Walter Benjamin and, you know, the kind of critical theory canon of the art world, and then having to participate in the labor market that's like extremely grueling. And you're like, wait, these things are totally divergent. One is a kind of a cultural elite sphere that gives me the theory. And then the other is the actual experience in which like, maybe this theory is not even relevant at some point. Yeah, a strange thing to make sense of once you enter the world. What about artists that were influential to you around that time?
I spent a lot of time looking at like V.S. Solomon. I was just talking to one of our PAs here about growing up in Texas and the accessibility of the sky. And so that was a big, big influence. I worked with a lot of like Chicago artists, like Andrew Falkowski and Michelle Grabner. And,
oh, wow.
I didn't get to work with her directly, but loved her work and her paintings. And she was another kind of like person who really nurtured young artists and ran the Suburban and, you know, got to see a lot
She's
of artists.
She's revered in the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Milwaukee too.
Yeah, but there's such a culture of like incubating young artists and like providing them a place to show their work. And it goes hand in hand with, you know, having an apartment gallery or running a little project space. That is just so much more available there than it is. At least here in New York City now, it's much more affordable, much easier to kind of get by, and space is more available.
I used to run an apartment gallery that was like four blocks that way from where we are, and it was like the tiniest little shoebox. And before we had the opening, because we lived there, we'd have to take our couch that barely fit in this Chinatown apartment, pile all of it into the other room. That was basically like a kind of fake wall that divided this space. And it was, it was so cramped and it was so hot. So bring us up to speed then. You're in school in Chicago. How do you find your way to New York?
I came to New York for work. I got to work at Sculpture Center as the operations manager there for a number of years. Yeah. So I came here for work and to pursue life as an artist too. Mm-hmm. I really thought, you know, being in New York City, like finding a community of artists here, I'd be able to make work. And I wanted to pursue a career in the arts. So Sculpture Center was my first full-time job working directly in the arts and supporting artists who are making work. And it's a really cool, great program.
without pissing off any of our friends or colleagues, are you similarly shocked and dismayed about the level of affluence in the American art world and its system of private patronage versus the like actual experience of working in this city and trying to make ends meet? Like that to me was kind of a radicalizing experience to see like how many resources were available to these people and then how hard you had to work to just pay the rent every month.
Oh yeah, it's shocking. Like the wealth that has been captured in New York City by a very small number of people, it's really unbelievable. And when I worked at Sculpture Center, sometimes I'd be kind of tasked with delivering artwork to various apartments or whatever. And you end up like at the doorstep of some like Chelsea townhouse and kind of like looking in and it's like, oh, I didn't know like electrical sockets could be shaped that way. Or did it be like something like that? Or just like, whoa, what?
Yeah. I'm going to chase a rabbit hole for a little bit. We can put this behind the paywall if it's a little bit too niche. So when you were on the stream with Hassan, he showed you a video that was an early piece from Zohran was the speaker in the video. I think this was around 2019, talking about housing for all. That video happened to be produced by the Gravel Institute, which was, you know, we're going back a ways here, but that was like the big hope for the left doing messaging online. And fast forward about, you know, 6 years, founders of the Gravel Institute now work for Mark Andreessen, venture capitalist, A16Z. This is someone that you would put on the New Right, who, you know, references the work of Curtis Yarvin and these type of characters. So that's a pretty big 180. Mm. They now run the media department for A16Z. And I'm curious if you have known people in your personal life that haven't just become kind of political nihilists, but have maybe even leaned in towards these right-wing ideas in the last few years.
I think the answer is no, unfortunately, if that ends the rabbit hole. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Thankfully, no. I'm trying to think. No, got no examples there.
I'll keep all of this behind the paywall, but like, clearly the class position of artists is like, well, they can really be won over. They're small business owners, you know, so it's quite easy. But the number of people who kind of made the shift like so rapidly and not just like leaned a little bit, but made it so hard. I would not have thought that was possible like 6 years ago. Mm. I thought that, you know, we'll lose a few. Every coalition loses a few. But like people that I felt early work was so influential. Mm. I learned so much from him, you know, Marxist criticism, and then makes a pretty big shift that he will talk about and has talked about. But it is really, really staggering the degree to which that has... just like kind of completely uncritical embrace of this stuff. When it comes to the Gravel Institute kids, I feel like I could have saw that coming. They were like teenage meme posters, and it's like you can't trust them with like safeguarding the revolution. Okay, but all of that is too in the weeds. How about Section 230? What are your thoughts on Section 230? Yeah, see, no one knows. We're now on the my docket of all the things. So I've done this now like 4 or 5 times, and no one is kind of familiar with it. The experience of the European Union, I was like, it is worse than I ever could have imagined. Mm. Like the stuff that I wrote 8 years ago, no one was going to listen to an artist. We patiently built up a platform to basically give like, here is a agenda. Here's a policy prescription about how to use social media. Mm. These things will not work. Here are the like with statistics and citations and examples. Don't even try this because it's not going to work for us. And so I'm trying to bring that mindset to now. It's like, what do we need to be looking down the pipeline at? And what can we get 8 years ahead of? So Section 230 is the exemption in the law that makes platforms not responsible for the material that they publish. Mm. So if the New York Times published an opinion piece that has, you know, say, God forbid, there's a lunatic who shows up to comment ping pong and hurts someone in the real world, based on what they wrote, they are somehow accountable or responsible for that. That exemption is given to platforms because Facebook can't be accountable for what everybody says. However, Facebook has the financial incentives where they profit from amplifying the most crazy incendiary stuff that people write.
Yeah.
So it's a really weird double bind because it's an uncomfortable topic around like free speech. I mean, we're not preventing anyone from saying anything. We're just like preventing them from amplifying it. But I wonder, I'm kind of wondering if not specifically Section 230, what are your thoughts on these recommendation algorithms and their impact onto a democratic society where we're supposed to have reasonable conversations with our neighbors?
Yeah, and they're not good. And we, you know, talking about people who are maybe more conspiratorially minded than they were before, I think this is like an effect of having, you know, these algorithms that, promote the kind of like most kind of like radical, incendiary, commentary. This is what it spins out, you know? It's making people in some ways like unreachable, and that's bad for democracy. Like just as like a canvasser who has to go talk to people, you know, we're not always able to get the anti-vaxxer to agree that healthcare should be free for everyone at the point of service. And you know, these tech companies are making incredible profits off of that too, undermining our democracy in this way, kind of like destroying the possibility of like open and thoughtful dialogue, like all of that.
Yeah. So like if 10 to 15% of people were like theocrats or unreachable or like didn't even care about democratic deliberation, that percentage of society is getting bigger and approaching like 30%, because they're in a media environment that is giving them like, you know, insane algorithmic nonsense.
Yeah.
And so I think in the kind of conversation we were having before, like getting upstream of the problem, this might be a serious consideration.
Yeah.
Have you heard, so Ro Khanna, I picked this up from him, but he has part of his platform is to repeal 230 for platforms that use algorithmic recommendation. Has that come across your desk? I'm realizing this is a pretty niche field.
Yeah, it hasn't yet, but okay. I mean, that's definitely interesting. It's going to be, yeah.
I mean, it might be one of the things that we look into for this show just because like nobody's talking about it. So, okay, something to add to the docket.